this time I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 993. And Brad, will you tell us about the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 993 requires State Department of Fish and Wildlife to offer animal taken for damage control first to landowner incurring damage, requires State Fish and Wildlife Director to compile a bimonthly report about animals taken for damage control. Under current law, a person may take cougar, bobcat, red fox, bear, game mammals, game birds, and fur-bearing mammals causing damage to land or crops without a permit so long as the taking is not prohibited by the State Fish and Wildlife Commission. The law requires an immediate report of the taking to an authorized state wildlife representative. That representative is responsible for disposing of the animal according to commission directives. Senate Bill 993 is intended to address situations where landowners lawfully take wildlife without a permit. According to the bill's sponsors, there have been instances where the commission has refused to allow landowners to keep the lawfully taken animal carcass and instead dispose of them by destruction and or burial. First up to testify, we have Rod Harker with the Oregon Sportsman Defense Fund.
Mr. Chair, I'm a member of the committee. For the record, I'm Rod Harker with Oregon Sportsman Defense Fund. And we ask that this bill be sponsored based upon a police investigation that I have entered into the record. Some time ago, a member in Roseburg took a bear on a damage complaint. The bear was turned in. I think we heard most of this during the informational hearing on bear and cougar in the spring, so I'm going to keep it very brief. The bear was asked for. The meat was at, the landowner asked to have the meat from the bear. The local biologist refused to do that. And to make a long story short, that bear and another bear were dumped out in a, out on a back road. This is not an isolated incident, but Mr. Jones, who testified here before, testified that he had been to the various missions and other places in Roseburg and had found only one bear that had been turned in for consumption. This bill says that the landowner experiencing the damage is given the first right of refusal to take the animal. That's all the bill says. We have an administrative rule that says Fish and Wildlife may do this now. We want to ensure that there is no more waste of these animals, and we want it, would like to have it required that they tell the landowner they may have the bear. The landowner could still reject it. The arguments against the bear, or they don't want to do it because the bear could have trichinosis or could be spoiled or for whatever reason, we think are easily addressed as they currently are an administrative rule by a release of liability by the landowner. There are some record-keeping requirements built into the bill that I believe Mr. Rob Clawerder will address, and that would end my testimony. And would answer any questions that you or the committee might have.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Glenn Stonebrink, Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink, the State Executive Vice President for the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Very briefly, we just believe that the landowner who is providing, who has been providing the feed for these animals, and that's obviously where they will be taken, should also have the right to that animal when they are taken. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Thanks, Glenn. Well, I think what I'm going to do, or we could do that.
That's it? No,
I see what you're saying. All right. Yes. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to close the public hearing temporarily on Senate Bill 993, and I'm going to open a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures. Brad, tell us what we have. We have LC.
LC 4158 is a resolution urging the President and Congress to fund goose depredation programs in Oregon.
Mr. Chair?
Senator DeDuke.
I move that the committee introduce LC 4158, dated 4/12/99, as a committee bill.
Without objections? Ordered. I'm going to close the work session on the committee bill, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 993.
Rod Clowder, Oregon United Sporting Dog Association.
Senator George, how are you doing?
Chairman George, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rod Clowder, representing Oregon United Sporting Dog Association. I think we're partially responsible for this bill. Our hope is that it will accomplish what we've been asking for, and I'm not sure it's been completely forthcoming in the last several years. Full and accurate record keeping of animals that are taken on damage. The landowner being able to retain that animal is an item, and I'm not sure that I can give you any lead pipe proof on that. Our suspicion, from anecdotal evidence at least, is that there are situations in which, especially with the liberalization of cougar tags, the availability, year-round seasons, extended seasons, so on and so forth, and probably a general dislike for cougars in a lot of areas. But people, it is more convenient if it is your anticipation that you might want to keep the animal to go and get a sport tag, and that animal, in fact, is a damage or possibly a threatening situation. And there again, just to avoid the hassle of having to call it in and report it and so on and so forth, the animal is taken either before or after the purchase of a sport tag. The situation in Roseburg is the driving force behind the landowner being allowed to keep it also, so that is not, the waste of a game animal is repugnant, at least. We'd just like to make sure that the animals that are taken, if it's a sport take, so be it. If it's damaged, though, that's the column that ought to end up in at the end of the year. And the availability of those records is should be just a housekeeping matter. I have no written testimony. If there's any questions you'd like to ask, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
I agree with you on the wastage issue and that should not occur ever. And the idea of keeping records is always a good idea.
Yes.
Rich Berry, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Good evening. Good evening, Senator George, members of the committee. My name is Rich Berry. I'm the Wildlife Division Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I would like to just express a couple of concerns with the bill that we have. And I might first address the issue that Mr. Harder brought up. We did, in fact, have an issue where controversy arose whether one of our employees improperly disposed of a bear that was taken on damage. As a result of that incident, we did, in fact, work with a group that Senator Fisher was a party to during the interim, which dealt with the sale of wildlife parts. And one of the issues we asked them to address was specifically this bear issue. What I have attached to you, to the statement that we have provided to you, is a copy of our administrative rules. And I would direct your attention on the first page, the second column, right at the very top, where it's the portion of 635002008. In there, the result of that, you will see number 2, that talks about black bear taken on damage. From that one, we have now given the guidance through administrative rules to our employees on the priority for disposal of those animals, and it is in fact that the landowner shall have first choice on that. The issue that we have with the bill is we think it has inadvertently opened up the portion as you read Section 3 of the bill that included in Section 3, and if you have a copy of the bill in front of you on line 20, the word game mammal is also present in that section. Game mammal, under the damaged ones, as we talk about, are deer, elk, those sorts of things. We work very hard with landowners to try to minimize damage from deer, elk, those types of things under a number of programs, with kind of a last resort is to issue a permit for a kill permit. If the permit is issued, again, going back to your administrative rules on the very first one, is those animals then go to a charity, that type of thing. They are not offered to the landowner. That's to reduce an incentive that you suddenly just start hunting for damage because you may need some additional meat, those sorts of things, even though we're working under permits. We do issue a number of permits statewide, and again, we've had very few complaints from landowners that they do, in fact, have to go back to a charity, that type of thing. We've also had some complaints from adjacent landowners when we've offered a kill permit. Why did you do that? That was actually my friend, that deer, and even though the other one does. When we talk about the method of disposal that it's going to charity, that seems to alleviate the problem for us having issued the kill take permit. The other one about the bill is on the final section was to go to a 30-day reporting period. Our concern is just an increased workload. Our district biologists do, in fact, keep track through the complaint forms of the things that happen, and what we do is compile this information on an annual basis and just put out on an annual basis. It's just an increased workload to start reporting it every 30 days, so that would be our concern. But we believe that we have the essential elements of this bill already covered by existing Oregon administrative rules.
First, isn't this 30 days actually an internal notice?
It's still a workload, Senator George. What we do is, our workload, the number of permits that we have or potentially have can be, as you take into bear, cougar, and deer, into the 2,000 statewide. And again, we just take one time and we go through them and we total them all up to fill into our annual reports. And particularly the one that we would have the difficulty dealing with is trying to do some assessment of what that value of the damage was done. The landowners, we don't ask that question from them. They would have difficulty in providing it. We would certainly have difficulty in obtaining that information. And I believe presented earlier, Sheriff Community Department of Agriculture presented a survey, kind of where they had surveyed and came up with some estimates, and those are probably as close in the ballpark as we can probably come on a statewide basis.
Okay, Rich, I had, I remember it's been quite a number of years ago, and we had to remove some deer that were destroying the new covert planting. And we contacted the folks that were on the list, charitable organizations and such, and no one wanted the deer. And we literally pushed those deer over the side of the hill. I mean, it was just ridiculous. First of all, they should have been disposed of that way. And I could have found people who could have utilized that meat, and I can see a little bit of reason. What suggestions do we have? Do you have to make this bill work to be more reasonable? In other words, to solve the problem that's been described, because we do know how these things are being disposed of, and yet at the same time offer this to a landowner who may have, in fact, been suffering the damage. I mean, that was very expensive deer meat to me, and to actually have it just wasted was a little bit on the offensive side.
Senator George, I'm not sure exactly what the administrative rules may have been at that time. I think now we have in process dealing both with some game animals and also with some hatchery returns that we have upon local food banks, charity organizations, and so on that we can work with, that we can now dispose of a large number of edible animal parts. And I think working with our local biologists who work with a number of these, that we could probably solve that problem if that was one that was difficult in finding before.
Okay, if we struck the word first on line 24, page 1, and said what it was read in the Department of Agriculture, Fish and Wildlife, it would offer the animal to the landowner encouraging the damage, and that could allow some discretion for low-income charitable institutions and so on. The other thing is, wouldn't this literally be like an email transfer of that data from one branch of state fish and wildlife to another?
Senator George, what happens on a kill permit, I think I have one here just to show you what the individual is issued. They are issued a tag, which then when the animal is turned over to a rendering or a processing plant or something, so it goes, and then and the remaining half of the tag is turned in. That does not happen necessarily in a timely manner. The kill permit could be issued for a three-month period, for example. So that it's not an instantaneous one. An individual may have a kill permit which allows them to take 2 to 4 animals. not just one animal. And that's what we have a concern, I guess, that with a game animal that is, in fact, one that's a hunted species, very valuable, deer, elk, that we may see an abuse of the system just trying to acquire additional animals. And again, I would just reiterate, I believe that we have the thing adequately covered for bear cougar, strictly bear and cougar, which was the landowner did not get the bear necessarily before. We now have that in administrative rules.
Yeah, Rich, wouldn't you be able to track someone? You suspect that the person's looking to fill the refrigerator with meat. You're not going to issue them any additional permit. If you even suspect that they might, you might give them one and then check back to see, you know, because there is an inspection done, I think, today as to whether or not you really have damage. You have to establish that first.
Senator George, that is generally correct, although we can, in a number of times, if we have damage in the area, we will essentially accept you have damage just because we've had reported damage. We may not physically be able to look at every damage complaint. Again, deer and elk damage complaints last year were over 1,400 statewide. So we have to deal kind of within our capabilities to be able to monitor the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 993, and I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 988. Tell us about the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 988 directs the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to submit programs to obtain control over marine mammal population in Oregon waters from the federal government. Currently, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, a federal statute, protects seals, sea lions, and other marine mammals as threatened species. The federal protection afforded by the Act limits the ability of states to control marine mammal populations. According to the bill's sponsor, the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, marine mammal populations have grown dramatically and pose a serious threat to endangered salmon due to predation. Additionally, sea lions pose a threat to public safety when they cannot be deterred from docks and marinas. Senate Bill 988 directs the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to submit a plan to the United States Secretary of Commerce for transfer of management authority over marine mammals within Oregon waters. Such a transfer would allow state wildlife authorities to manage marine mammal populations to minimize predation of endangered or threatened fish. The federal act also requires an optimum sustainable population. According to the bill's sponsors, the current explosion in marine mammal populations demonstrates this goal has been achieved in the Pacific Ocean. Therefore, the bill defines optimum sustainable populations as the number of marine mammals that are not in the waters of the state of Oregon. First up to testify, we have Glenn Stonebrink from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
Ken and Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink for the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Appreciate the opportunity to testify before your fine committee. Years ago, like 50 years ago or so, I can remember my folks taking me to the coast, and the only place I could see seals or sea lions was the sea lion cage. And, of course, since the protection under the Marine Mammals Protection Act of seals and sea lions and other mammals, the population has grown, and that's pretty obvious. Everybody is willing to agree to that. It was about 5 or 6 years ago, and I still have the article, it came out of the Wall Street Journal, in which it stated that 65% of the steelhead runs at Ballard Locks were being eaten by seals and sea lions. Now, 65%, 65 out of every 100 salmon or steelhead that returned, after all of that agony of getting to the ocean, living through that 3 or 4 year cycle and coming back, to be eaten or at least killed, not actually eaten, but killed, is astonishing. And that was several years ago. 2 years ago, as I worked for the Senate Ag Committee here in the legislature, I helped draft a memorial to Congress. And it passed, and it was to get the federal government to take some serious looks at ways to control the populations of seals and sea lions. Also, during the last session, there were different conversations with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. They were asked to pursue a request to the Secretary of Commerce about the control of the pinnipeds, the seals and sea lions. I recall the statement being somewhat along these lines, that it is necessary to establish an optimum sustainable population before the Secretary of Commerce would allow for state control of these animals, and that's very difficult to do. Now, I understand an optimum sustainable population, what they're talking about, is, in fact, that population that basically will sustain itself. And there is a definition in the handouts that I gave to you. Now, recently, the National Marine Fisheries Service published a document, and most of you probably have this document, that reports on the impact of California sea lions and Pacific Harbor seals on salmon in the West Coast ecosystem. And that, if you look at that, I've highlighted some things on the last two pages of your handout.
Glenn, did you say again where that was?
On the handout, the last mm-hmm. two pages, I've highlighted a couple areas.
Right.
Just on those two pages that you might want to look at. In fact, the very last page, I have a red line under that part that talks about, this is now coming from the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the importance of that is that is the agency under the Department of Commerce that does the protecting of these very same animals. Now the agency that's protecting them is giving you a report, and this is what it says. In situations where California sea lions or Pacific Harbor seals are preying on salmonoids that are listed or are proposed for candidates for listing under the ESA, well, that's basically all of our fisheries now, immediate use of lethal removal by state or federal resource agencies officials would be authorized. Now, I think what you see in here is kind of a hidden meaning from the National Marine Fisheries Service when they say lethal removal by state or federal. They know, and we know, that within the Marine Mammals Protection Act, there is the authority for the state to take control of these seals and sea lions. In the hall earlier today, I was talking to someone who said, the state has no control and can't take control. Well, that's not true. It can if it does certain things. Also, just recently, I didn't make a handout of this, but this also came from the Department of Commerce, in which they report that sightings increase, incidents of sea lions that cannot be deterred from docks and marinas. Said sea lions and harbor seals may be a great threat to public safety at such locations. So we're not just talking about eating the endangered species anymore, protected species eating an endangered species. We're talking about a threat to human life or harm to humans. Now, I'm not sure this is true, and perhaps ODF&W will testify later, but I've understood that they may be in the second year of a three-year study to come up with, to figure out the optimum sustainable population. And I contend that now is the time. If not now, then we're always going to find excuses as to why the overpopulation of seals and sea lions will never be addressed. After all, if the seals and sea lions really are a huge detriment to the fish runs, and you all seem to know that they are, and if their numbers are reduced by the fact that this bill may pass, and it may actually bring some action, several thousand high-paid positions that are involved in the fish recovery issue, those positions may be lost. Now, we have an industry, it's a conflict industry, if you will, in this nation, and it seems to center in Oregon, that people like to make a lot of money over continual conflict and lawsuits and studies and recovery efforts. We would like to see this effort go through because we really believe that it would have a dramatic impact on the recovery of the salmon and sea lions. So, first of all, the reasons for Senate Bill 988 is it allows for the state to manage the populations of the seals and sea lions. That's now what I handed out on the first two pages. This comes from the Marine Mammals Protection Act, and I highlighted the areas, and on the first page, as you get down to about the 5th bullet there, it says the species is at its optimum sustainable population. And that is what is required, one of the main issues that is required before the state could get an approved management plan past the Secretary of Commerce. So this optimum sustainable population. On the second page of the handout, it's a highlight down at the bottom, part 9, the term optimum sustainable population means with respect to any population stock, the number of animals which will result in the maximum productivity of the population or the species, keeping in mind the carrying capacity of the habitat and the health of the ecosystem with which they form a constituent element. So,
Senator Fisher, I would consider that they have exceeded by far the optimum sustainable.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I totally agree. And that's what hopefully when we, I'll be done in just a second and we will address that. And I agree with you 100%. So secondly, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has been reluctant to move forward as a request for control. Third, the elusive optimal sustainable population question needs to be have a reasonable answer. Fourth, the Marine Mammals Protection Act is up for reauthorization in Congress this year. Now that's very important because if we do something as a state, I think Congress is going to be able to, will recognize that and allow one of the three coastal states, at least on the Pacific Ocean, to be able to take some definite action. So I, you know, that's again why we have to do it now. And fifth, the National Marine Fisheries Service is recommending the reduction of the pinniped population and recognizes that states have this authority under the Marine Mammals Protection Act. Now, all this bill does, it requires, first of all, that the ODFMW submit a request for management. I'm not attempting in this bill to tell you everything that will be in that. Mainly what we're trying to do is to address what, under law, what will be the optimum sustainable population. Now, what that is just this simple. That population that's in the ocean and or the waters of the United States as defined in the Marine Mammals Protection Act is that from the beach outward. Everything else from the beach inward are called waters of the state. So the optimum sustainable population would be all of those that are out there. Everything else would be above that level and the state then would have that control.
So Glenn, since the beach is not waters of the state, anything that basically what we're saying is you shall not enter into to the rivers or the bays of the state. So it wouldn't stop them from entering in upon the beaches or the cliffs or anything else. And
that's correct, Mr. Chairman. They could enter like the sea lion caves or on the beaches, that sort of thing. But once they come into the mouth of a river, then they would be under the control of the management program, whatever may be established by the state. And whether they want to do it by, well, I won't try to spend a lot of your time telling them how they might want to do it. Let them do that. We need to get moving forward on this, however.
Further questions? Glenn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fred is next.
Rich Berry, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Rich, first of all, before you begin, do you agree with the conclusions that Mr. Stonebrink had made about the legal implications of the Endangered Species Act? Or are you going to deal with that in your testimony?
Senator George, for the record, Rich Berry, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Wildlife Division Director. In my statement, I'll talk a little bit about the legal implications from what this is referring to. I do need to apologize to the committee. I hope to have Robin Brown, who's our marine mammal specialist, who's working heavily on this. He's in Seattle, chairing a state federal committee today. I will try to answer the questions to the best I can. I might also point out that attached to our testimony is, in fact, a House joint resolution or joint memorial, 0007, which my understanding was had been considerably discussed with the Stream Restoration and Species Recovery Committee, which Senator Ferrioli and Senator Dukes are both on. My understanding is that passed out of committee this morning, which I believe this is more appropriately the direction that
the state can legally be going and needs to be going, and it's really asking for the federal government to accept some recommendations that were developed by state and federal biologists to amend the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which would give the state some authority in some areas to deal with the issues. And I believe it will probably come back to the Senate side if, in fact, the House passes it. I'm not quite sure how that process works.
Rich, and it's really nice, but what we understand is that a House joint memorial, when it's passed, has about the value of the paper it was sent on. And I think what's happened here, I mean, we sat in the committee you mentioned and listened and watched the clubbing of the fish, you know, at the hatchery. And then we heard testimony about the fact that 100 or so native, quote, native fish that might make it back were facing an army of 600-plus seals and sea lions. And that right there, by any reasonable person, you would say, well, that is absolutely ridiculous. There's no way there will be a zero survival rate with a 6-to-1 ratio of seals and sea lions to the returning run. And so I appreciate your comments, but I think this is pretty weak need compared to where we need to be. We're talking about loss of these runs, and it's no longer a case of saying, gee, let's study it one more time. I think we have the answer to that. I've never talked to one person that didn't agree with us. Now we may hear testimony later that we have a major problem we need to address.
Senator George, I may wear two hats here at the moment. As you know, I used to be in our Fish Division until moving to the Wildlife Division. I don't think anyone will disagree that there is a problem out there. The biggest problem that we have as a state agency or the other state agencies is that we have a federally protected species and we have to operate under the federal law. Within the statements, the two portions of this bill, there are actually two components to that. One would be for the state to say we want to take over a management authority. For us to do that, we need to meet certain federal regulations, which we could not meet probably at this time. And some of that has to do with defining what the population status is. This one also, within House Bill 988, gives a definition for optimum sustained population. That, again, is defined by federal regulations. We cannot define that for the state's benefit. So those are the two issues that we have listed here within our testimony that we see the problems with. We do not disagree that we have some problems with marine mammals, and how can we effectively deal with that and retain control? So far under federal legislation, we cannot obtain control without going through a lot of hoops, and we can't meet those hoops.
Well, you don't know that, so you submit that request, which is described in the bill. And I would hope that you would, in fact, this bill passes and, in fact, is signed, you would take a more positive attitude towards asserting our authority over this population.
Senator,
because, you know, there is a mention in the information that was provided by Mr. Stonebrink that we do have an obligation to the whole ecological system and not to one mammal that has done very well on being restored.
Senator George, I assure you, if this is the intent of the legislation, this bill passes, we will do our best to implement it within the constraints of the federal act.
Senator Fisher.
I guess we need to spell it out. There's a good many of us that are getting downright tired that our state agencies can't get out there and start lobbying for us in Washington, D.C. and taking the side of the people that are having problems here in this state, keeping salmon runs going, keeping some of the other things going, and get rid of these problems and straighten them up. You're supposed to be working for the state. You're supposed to be interested in our state health and welfare, and you want to get all the money you can to operate your agencies from the state coffers, and somebody needs to start reviewing the mental attitude of leadership in these organizations that are not helping us. They're standing back always and washing their hands, oh, we can't do this, or oh, we can't do that. Well, it's about time that you determine that you can do some of that before you come down here and start asking us for great big budgets and all that kind of stuff to continue on in the way you're going, because we're getting kind of tired of this. I was just laughing at some of the emails that I'm getting on one of the bills here to do away with the state environmental protection law. We're tired of this. There's no way that a spotted owl would have gotten on the endangered species listing had we known how many of them there are right now. And yet, we can't make any headway whatsoever getting out from under this kind of garbage. We're tired of it. That kind of an excuse doesn't wash anymore. We need to have you guys back on our side
going out there, getting something done to get our people back in production, back at work, and back in the business of making a living and keeping our economy going now.
So noted, Ken Fisher.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much, Rich.
Thank you.
Jim Myron, Oregon Trap.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jim Myron, representing Oregon Trout. We've got a couple of concerns about this bill. One thing that hasn't been mentioned at all yet is what this would cost for this agency to do that and where the money would come from. They're already struggling with a huge shortfall in revenue and funding, so that's a concern of ours. The curious definition of optimum sustainable populations basically states that that the marine mammals in Oregon are not important for any purpose. That just doesn't make any sense to us. While we appreciate the Cattlemen's Association's concern about salmon recovery, it's Oregon Trout's position that we need to focus on human-induced causes of fish mortality, not natural causes. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Well, if we tell her.
Hey, we're going to stand at ease for a few minutes while we... We can do that. All right. Okay, and you're going to describe the amendments we have? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 988, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 993. And Brad, we have a compromise of amendments, and you're going to tell us about how we procedurally address this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rod Harder and Rich Berry were able to meet outside the room there, and they gave me some amendments that satisfy both of their concerns. On Senate Bill 993, the first page, line 23, the amendments, the conceptual amendments would read, in determining procedures for disposal, and then insert of bear and cougar, comma, the commission shall direct the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to first offer the animal to the landowner incurring the damage. And this amendment would satisfy Mr. Berry's concern about game animals being taken.
And that would be problem on your side of the 30 days, able to leave that.
Yeah, they didn't offer any amendments on that.
I will move the conceptual amendment to SB 993, the insertion of Outbear and Cougar on line 23, page 1, following for disposal.
Without objection? So moved. Senator Wild?
Sir, I move SB 993 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wild has moved Senate Bill 993 to the floor with a due pass as amended. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call a roll.
Senator
Fisher? Aye.
Senator Chairman?
Aye.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye. Bill is passed, and who would like to carry that? Sound like a Fisher bill.
Yeah, he's got the bear artifact.
You got it.
All right. Senator Fisher will carry. Okay, I'm going to close the work session.
Thank you, teammates.
We're here for you. We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 993, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 988.
Chair, I move SB 988 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any further discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Regarding the last testimony from Oregon Trout,
one of the best ways in the world to start making some more money for ODF&W is to get the problem fixed and getting some more license issues for fishermen to go out and fish. And they might even consider the fact that somebody might be willing to pay a little bit of a hunting license to go get a marine mammal. I don't see why they're any different than a bighorn or something like that. There are probably people out there that pay a pretty good little penny of an auction on a sea lion or two or something like that. I don't see why they wouldn't make a good stuffed animal just the same as anything else. And there might even be a lot of fishermen, while they don't have anything else to do, that might like to go out and help the problem and buy a license to do just that.
Thank you, Senator Fisher.
That would help solve the income problem, too.
Cool. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call a roll on Senate Bill 988.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye. Bill was passed. Who would like to carry it? I'll do it.
Thank you. You're good on Senator.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 988, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1111. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Wild, State Senator, District 8, which makes me remember that on our low sulfur fuel bills, I forgot to give my name for the record, but that's right.
That will be duly noted.
Thank you very much, sir. I brought this issue forward for several reasons. One, as most everyone knows, I like controversy. I like people having good, rambunctious public discussion of various issues that are important to us. And this issue has a great impact on the way we live, the way we make money, where we live, how we live. So I did want to bring it forward because in 1995 there were various changes made, and there was more or less somewhat consensus opinion reached as to what would be useful, although the number of people involved in that, I would have liked to have seen it be a larger number. But the fact is, we've had 4 years. What's happened? I've heard no feedback of any kind from anyone. And for me, I look at what happened when we brought forth the Oregon plan last session. And who took on that Oregon plan? Who filed suit against it? And what laws did they use to file suit? And in no way did they use state law. They used federal law in order to take on the Oregon plan. And almost every time I've observed anyone having difficulty with the way we're dealing with wildlife and various species and plants, they used federal statute in order to address the problem. And so I started asking myself, well, why exactly do we have this state statute? Quite clearly, in only rare circumstances does anyone, at least in terms of taking it to court, do they use the statute. And yet everyone out there in the agricultural community, in the forest timber industry communities, they have to abide by this every single day of the year. And that is a burden we place on them, good or bad. You can make your decision. But the fact is, it is a burden. And before I place a burden on someone, I want to know that it is completely and entirely necessary to do so. And so I understand this is probably not the single most dull issue to come before the legislature this year, but I actually was hoping for a larger turnout so that we could really get lambasted for bringing it forward. But nevertheless, I did want to keep the public discussion going as to how we do restrict the people of this state and under what conditions we do it, and to determine the balance between humans and various other species. But like in the previous bill, when we do have a threatened species and an endangered species, how do we balance that? Because our laws are not tremendously good at doing so. And when you have a pinniped taking care of picking off a salmon, what do you do in that situation? And actually, I think that's something that was rather poorly addressed when especially the Federal Endangered Species Act was put into place. But personally, I don't like playing God. I don't think we do an especially good job of it. And that's what we're trying to do, and we're doing a very poor job of it. Take, for example, in the mouth of the Columbia. We've got the Army Corps of Engineers to create two islands so that, what, the Caspian terns can live on them. And then, lo and behold, we find out, oh, geez, they're feeding off the salmon smolts. And so what do? We have an invasion of the islands by, I believe it's the Marines they use, to push the Caspian terns over to another island during the run of the smolts. Well, this is absurd. And this is taxpayers' money that we're using. And once again, I don't think we're using it very wisely. And so with that being the case, I'm just going to sit back and enjoy the discussion. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
Oh,
question.
I'm looking at somebody's testimony here, and they're saying at this time when the widespread salmon decline, this isn't the time to repeal this. Does the Oregon Endangered Species Act add anything to that that the federal government doesn't already cover?
At the moment, I know of nothing, and I know all of what has been imposed on the state of Oregon is based on federal statute, not on state statute. Additionally, as I would like to point out, one, you have the pinniped situation. Another, you have the Caspian tern situation. Another, we just went through a warm, dry period for the state, and we clearly appear, although I have questions, but appear to be entering a cooler, wet period, and lo and behold, we're starting to see returns increase, because with ocean conditions being what they are, when the food supply of the salmon returns to being off our coast, lo and behold, that's where the fish go to feed, and then they return back to the streams. If the food supply isn't there, they look for it. They go long distances. I mean, they head up toward Alaska during periods of warm ocean conditions where the food supply heads north. And that's where the fishermen go. Just watch where they go and you can tell where the salmon are, because the fishermen are not going to stick around where the salmon do not exist. And so, once again, is this nature at work, or is it human intervention that's bringing back the salmon? My argument would be nature has a much greater impact than we will ever have. But once again, that's a matter for debate.
Did you ask me a question?
Did I?
Uh-huh. Is this
Oregon
law?
Right at the start. So.
Right at the start,
yeah.
Okay. Long ago, I forgot. Anyway, my next
Thank
question,
you, Senator.
My next question is, I noticed that it says that we need this because there are species that are not federally listed, such as the gray whale, and on the decline. And do the Japanese whalers pay attention to our laws?
Actually, it's interesting because my brother-in-law used to be one of the chief negotiators on the International Whaling Commission. And the Japanese, we find, don't pay attention to many international laws involving whaling. They seem to have their own set of rules, and they aren't tremendously interested in what the rest of the world cares about. I also find it interesting because I've rarely seen a gray whale going up the Columbia River or up the Silas or anything like that. They, generally speaking, are outside of our boundaries, and so I don't think our state laws have a lot to do with gray whales, although I'm sure people will dispute that.
I have one last question. I noticed on the bill that you're speaking to today that sponsors are Senator Lyle, Senator Fisher, Senator George, and Senator Shannon. Do you think this bill has any chance in this committee?
Seeing the way things are going this session, I have my doubts.
So
Senator Wild, before you leave, you got really close to answering my question. But I would suspect that if we went back and checked the tapes when we passed this, when the legislature passed this, we would find that what we'd hoped to accomplish was that we were going to preempt and the federal government was going to say, oh, you have a wonderful plan. We just love it. You go right ahead and manage it. Tell us, what has been your reaction to how well that has worked, and do you think this will have any impact upon negotiations that we'll be doing with the federal government?
Actually, the state's actions in terms of protecting various species, I've been rather unimpressed with. I'm thinking back to all of my reactions, because I used to live out states and up in the upper Hood River Valley, and I was a good long-haired hippie who was out there making sure the world was safe for humanity. But I don't think much has been done in any way whatsoever using this statute. And there will be some who will argue, especially on sensitive plant species, and I do understand that. And I will tell you, I don't have a great knowledge or background on sensitive plant species. And so I may well learn something today, and I hope I do, because that's part of the reason of bringing this forward for the public discussion. But for the most part, no, it didn't preempt or change what the federal government did in any way. It wasn't held up as being the model for the nation. And it has been pretty much cast aside, and most all have used federal statute to do whatever they wish in this area.
Thank you very much. Brad, who's next?
Jerry Igo, Native Plant Society.
Jerry, I saw your head nodding back there. We were talking about the plant, so I thought you might be interested.
Good afternoon. My name is Jerry Igo. I've lived in Oregon for about 70 years now. I'm beginning to get the hang of it. I am the education chair for the Native Plant Society of Oregon, and I am familiar with sensitive plant species, although that's not primarily why I'm here to talk today. I came here today to tell you what a good thing the Oregon Endangered Species Act is, and what a bad idea it would be to repeal it. And that appears to be the intention in the summary of Senate Bill 1111, is repeal state provisions for protection of threatened or endangered wildlife or plant species. Good and bad value judgments. Who owns Oregon? Well, legislators don't. Lobbyists don't. Exploiters don't. Developers, loggers, farmers, miners don't. Nor does it belong to an elite few who think that they are delegated by some higher authority to use the land as only they see fit. So I guess it covered everybody, didn't I? None of us own the land called Oregon. We are here on Earth for just a little while to spend our time living on the land. The best we can say for ourselves is that we are caretakers or stewards of the land. What was here when we came should still be here when we're gone. We should walk lightly enough upon the earth so that our children's children may experience it in the same manner as our fathers' fathers. In the early 1970s, with the full approval of Governor Tom McCall, interest was focused on flora and fauna in Oregon, which were considered to be rare. Dr. Kenton Chambers, curator of the Oregon State University Herbarium, spoke for the plants, and some of us listened. Leading zoologists of Oregon spoke for the animals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish. Spurred on by the United States Endangered Species Act of 1973, a computerized data bank of Oregon's rare plant and animal species was established. It is the Oregon Natural Heritage Database. In cooperation with the Nature Conservancy, the Native Plant Society of Oregon, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and many leading botanists and zoologists, updated listings were made and published. By 1987, the Oregon Senate Bill 533 was passed, and with its passage, responsibility for plants which are threatened or endangered in Oregon is vested in the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Fish, animals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians are under Oregon Fish and Wildlife Service. Well, now what good has all this done? In fact, I heard just a few minutes ago that it's done no good at all. But there are 9 federally listed plant species in Oregon, and we've had to twist the Fed's arms considerably to get even that many. There are 61 listed species under the State Endangered Species Act, and there should be 600 or 700. One of the good things that has happened is Oregon Department of Transportation in 1994 and 95 developed a plan to survey for every threatened or endangered species.
Just a minute, stop right there.
Mm-hmm.
ODOT into the endangered species business?
You bet.
Thank you.
ODOT is charged with the responsibility of managing the endangered species on their...
Do you know what their budget right amount is?
Pardon?
The budget for that?
They have a budget for it. It's in their environmental department.
Thank you.
Okay. And... since I drove 51,000 miles surveying for those plants, I know that the program worked. And there are more than 100 sites in the state where rare plants are managed by ODOT for their protection. Now, some people might not think that's very important.
Okay. I know where some of those are, and they're great big weed patches.
Well,
eyesores.
Some people think that.
Were you paid by ODOT to do that survey?
Contract.
Contracted, okay. Yeah. How much did they pay you over that period of time?
Well, they didn't. They didn't pay me enough so that I felt like it was a very big salary for covering that many miles.
Over that period.
How many miles? You said how many miles.
I drove 51,000 miles.
And ODOT paid it. Oh, that's wonderful.
No, ODOT didn't pay me mileage.
Oh.
They paid me a total of $16,000 to cover the whole state. In other words, it was a labor of love on my part.
Mm-hmm.
51,000 miles of pollution.
Pardon?
51,000 miles of pollution.
Okay.
Waste of oil and gas.
Well, I can see, Senator Fisher, that you would feel that way because you probably aren't as close to the land as some other people who are in this room.
Might be a lot closer to it.
Now, what it has done, though, is ODOT inspired at a federal highways national conference. ODOT inspired several other states to do exactly the same thing, including California and Florida and Texas. Well, another thing that it's done is it's awakened us to take care of our lands in a morally responsible manner. It obviously hasn't awakened us enough. If our Endangered Species Act has flaws, it's that it's too permissive. The idea of attacking it as too restrictive is irresponsible, reprehensible, and a recipe for disaster. The real owners of the land, the western lily, the western pond turtle, the peregrine falcon, the fisher, and the Cascades frog, have voices with moral imperative behind them. Thank you.
We have a person who's driven quite a distance. So, Brad, go ahead.
51,000, huh?
51,000.
Mr. Gruber? Is Mr. Gruber out there?
Yes, sir. Oh, you didn't write, no, not the 51,000.
That would be quite a...
Okay, let's just go ahead and go back to the... We'll go back to that. Oh, okay, we thought you'd driven a considerable distance.
Mike Swain, Mayor of Salem.
Mike, how are you?
Good afternoon. Senator George and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you. I walked over, didn't drive. and it was less than a mile, actually, from my office here. Well, I'm not unmindful of the fact that everybody sitting before me, and one that left just before me, are sponsors of this bill. And I'm not here to talk about philosophy. I'm here to talk a little bit about politics and practicalities, and to ask you to soberly reflect on whether this is a bill you want to advance for those practical and political reasons. It's kind of ironic. Yesterday at this same time, I was in the same room sitting in actually that chair before Co-Chairman Messerly and his group discussing how we're going to respond to the Endangered Species Act and the listing. And we're talking about the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and all of the complications that involves. And I think that brings up really kind of the essence of what I want to talk to you just real briefly about, and that's that the federal system, good, bad, or indifferent, the federal system abhors a vacuum. And whenever it finds a vacuum, it moves its tentacles into every last little nook and cranny of your life and my life and the lives of our communities. And what I'm concerned about primarily with this bill is it creates a vacuum. It creates a vacuum that will invite the federal government to be more involved. Now,
Mr. Mayor, don't you think with the Salmon Plan and on the watershed councils and everything we've done to address what the federal government has suggested that we do, that we've in fact more than filled the vacuum that this thing, which doesn't seem to have done much, can you specifically tell me what it has done?
Sure. Let me tell you how it has operated with a group that I have the pleasure of sharing with Representative Messerly. Served on the Salmon Recovery Strategy Team, and I can assure you that we were able, by virtue of the Oregon plan, to persuade NIMS not to list the coastal coho nor the spring chinook or steelhead. We were able to persuade them that the local attention, the statewide attention to the problem, was sufficient to keep there from being listing. And it wasn't the federal authority that actually got us the listing. It was a federal judge. And in fact, the federal agency deferred so greatly to the state effort on the Oregon plan that it joined us in the appeal of the judges initially, in the appeal of the judge's decision. So there is, an absolutely excellent example of where the state activity in terms of its protection for an endangered species actually persuaded the federal authority, NIMS in that instance, to defer. So the judge came in and said, no, we're going to change that, but that wasn't what the federal government said. That was a judge. So I suggest that if you're not really terribly enamored of the Endangered Species Act, that might be one reason why you want to maintain the state act so as to take the pressure off of the feds for looking for those vacuums and coming here. There's a couple other reasons I'd like to brief. Yes.
How exactly did your last statement have anything to do with the Oregon ESA?
Well, I think it shows that the federal agency in this instance, NIMS, did in fact defer to state action on a sensitive species, namely the coastal coho, the spring chinook, and the steelhead.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I don't see anything in this bill that says the state can't take some action on endangered species without the Endangered Species Act. There's absolutely nothing that would stop it from considering things individually as they're doing now with the salmon and stuff like that. They have absolutely nothing to do with them being listed on the ESA.
Senator George, Senator Fisher, I agree with you that there is nothing that precludes that from happening, but I think that having the kind of statutory scheme that is in there will persuade the federal agency not to take resolute action because there is a structure there. The very issue that the federal judge struck down in terms of the Oregon plan was that it didn't have the kind of traffic that it thought would sufficiently procure the recovery of those species. And so I think that this provides some structure to defer federal action.
That didn't work in the cases of all the things basically that have been listed by the federal government, regardless of whether we've had an ESA or not. And I fail to see how this even addresses this. We'd be better to take our own look at whatever that is having a particular problem and look at it individually and make some judgments rather than having an ESA act that ties up everything once it gets on, and just the same as it ties up everything that the federal ties up everything that they get on.
It makes no sense to me to have something like this that just blocks actually looking at something in a meaningful way. They do what they want to do regardless of what we want to do. We've maybe been singularly, if we have to bend double like we did for the Oregon plan and everything else, then maybe we better let them show us up and then worry about it when they're not getting any taxes out of Oregon.
At least they're required to send money when they do that.
Big deal.
Chairman George, I just have a couple more points. I think that, as the speaker before me mentioned, there's a number of species, plants, particularly that are protected under the state law, that's not protected under the federal statute. And I think the state of our knowledge about a lot of the values of some of our plant materials, especially, is rather still rudimentary. For example, we have the yew tree up in our watershed in the National Forest. There's a trash tree. You know, bullet over, put it into the trash pile and burn it. But all of a sudden, somebody came on to the discovery that yew tree provided what's called Taxol. And Taxol has become a very important drug, really, in the fight against cancer. So we don't often know what is out there to be discovered. And as plants go extinct with or without our assistance, we lose the opportunity to find that out. We also, I think, risk federal funding, matching funds. We get a fair amount of, I don't know the amount, but my understanding is we get a fair amount of matching funds that really help research activities at our colleges and universities here in the state of Oregon that will be jeopardized, I believe, if we don't, in fact, keep the state statute.
California, Washington, and Idaho have their own endangered species?
My understanding is that all western states presently do, and if we were to rescind ours, we would be the only western state not to have one. And that really brings me to my final point. You know, the city of Salem has five sister cities throughout the world, all the way from Kawagoe, Japan, to Salem, India. And the state of Oregon has a certain image in the world, and nationally too, but even throughout the world, as a place that really goes the extra mile to take care of its wildlife and plant life. The message may be more than the effect, but the message going out that the state is maybe backing away from that kind of extra mile that we have gone to with respect to plant and animal life, I think would be a disappointment to the image that we well deserve throughout the entire world. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I would like to comment that you've seen from this legislature an effort to address research, an effort to address anything that actually produces positive results rather than feel-good rhetoric. And, this is going to be an interesting debate. We thank you very much.
That's what democracy is all about.
Sure.
Debate happens, as they say.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Randy's next one.
Regna Merritt, Oregon Natural Resource Council.
Chair, committee member, thanks for this opportunity to testify. Members of Oregon Natural Resource Council and many thousands of Oregonians across the state will oppose Senate Bill 1111 because of the damage to Oregon's ability, it damages Oregon's ability to protect our natural heritage. And I want to remind you that the state of Oregon's policy is the state's policy to prevent the serious depletion of any indigenous species. To this end, one of the programs of the Department of Fish and Wildlife has established the following objectives: restore the resident breeding populations of state-listed threatened and endangered species to a non-listed status, and to prevent species from qualifying as threatened or endangered by identified sensitive species and taking actions that will maintain their status. So two of the tools for meeting these objectives are the State Endangered Species Act and rules, and the sensitive species rule. It seems illogical, at the least, that at a time when we're seeing imperiled salmon in drastic decline, that we would remove one or two of these tools from Oregon's toolkit. And this bill encourages the demise of some of our sensitive species, which we would prefer not to see listed as threatened or endangered, by allowing the take, sale, and export of species that are not federally listed, but are rare or on decline in Oregon. It also amends the Oregon Public Records Law by allowing anyone to determine the location of a population of a threatened endangered species. The purpose of the current exemption from disclosure is to prevent harm from coming to these species and their habitat. So what public interest purpose is served by the repeal of this public record provision? If you want to move species off of the endangered list or prevent them from getting on the list, you've just hamstrung yourself in one important regard. We think it's important that federal funds be available to help recover species, and state conservation programs attract federal matching funds to manage species on state lands and on federal lands where federal actions have resulted in species being brought to the brink of extinction. And I want to remind you that this endangered Oregon Endangered Species Act law does not affect private lands unless the landowner expressly requests state assistance. These state lists provide an early warning sign for us and help us and land managers develop recovery strategies for species before they are in deeper trouble. So this is why we oppose the act, and we ask you to change your mind on it. Thank you.
Stephen Gaffori.
Good evening. How are you?
Evening, Mr. Chair.
I'm really glad that I'm making sure that I get these lobbyists to earn their keep. So
that's correct.
I like bringing forward these bills that get them to come in and testify, because we just don't get enough of them showing up at our committee.
Five, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here representing the Wildlife Society and American Fishery Society, the professional scientific societies of biologists. And I'd like to thank Senator Wild for keeping me from family dinner tonight, but it also keeps me putting the bread on the table. So I guess it's one half a dozen the other. Seriously, I would like to congratulate Senator Wild. I think that it's important, especially in these days of term limits, that we go back and review the things and refresh ourselves on why do we have these laws. Just putting them on the books and letting them stay there forever and ever, and not revealing them is probably not good policy for the state of Oregon. So I think it's a good idea to have this discussion we're having tonight. Now, our folks are, the biologists are not excited about limiting the Threatened Endangered Species Act in the state of Oregon. We reminded you, as ONRC just did, that it is a relatively weak act compared to the federal act. It only applies to state lands, and what it does is direct those state agencies to develop plans for within their scope and their range that they have as their obligation to the state agency. So it doesn't require them to go outside of their scope in order to preserve animals or plants. The science right now shows that there are many plant, wildlife, and fish species which are at risk of extinction. These species may not be sufficiently at risk throughout the range so to justify a federal listing, but they are at risk of being lost as part of Oregon's natural heritage. There are five wildlife species on Oregon's threatened or endangered species list that do not appear on the federal list: the kit fox, the wolverine, the inland population of western snowy plover, the gray whale, and the Arctic peregrine falcon, and those two are in the process, we hope, of being removed because they're no longer as threatened as they were in the past. ODF&W lists 136 wildlife and fish species as sensitive. Many of these, if not effectively researched and managed, which is done by our people, could be essentially listed as threatened or endangered either at the state or federal level. This list of sensitive species even includes our state bird, the western meadowlark. You've heard some of this. I'll try not to be too repetitive. There is a problem of losing money for fish management research, fish and wildlife management research because of this law. And in summary, we think that It has proved to be, while not the greatest benefit to Oregon's plants and animals, because it is a relatively limited act, neither has it proved to be terribly detrimental, because it is restricted in its scope, and we think that overall it's better that we keep it than we delete it.
Senator Weil?
Could you explain to me how it would jeopardize funding to recover at-risk species? Because it would seem to me that just testimony like this in front of a legislative panel could cause action to take place to put something into effect, such as the Oregon plan, if in fact we consider something to truly be at risk. And so how would it jeopardize funding? I'm just very curious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, I hope to have a biologist here to present this testimony with me. I couldn't get one. ODFMW is here, and they can tell you more specifically about federal matching monies that we get. You're familiar, for example, with the income tax checkoff and the money that goes to non-game species from that, and that money is matched as much as 7-1. And the money that's used for research on threatened and endangered species and other non-game species. And there is money that specifically comes because of this.
So, Corey, can you tell me what 500 wildlife biologists, are these all mainly employed or doing contract work for state and federal government?
Mr. Chair, that's an interesting question. We have people that represent state and federal government employees. There are also a large number that work for public utilities or timber companies. Almost any large company that's involved in resource management these days needs to have biologists on staff. So we have a lot of people that work in those areas. We have a large number of independent consultants that do work on an on-call basis for whoever needs to know what's going on biologically in the state.
Well, my question is this, is that, you know, one of the things we run into, we'll ask a question of what's the science behind that? And we never seem to get a really solid answer. And I wonder why 500 wildlife biologists wouldn't have us answers by now, because we probably paid these folks a substantial amount of money.
Kennedy George, unfortunately, my biologists are not going to make very much money. They're a relatively low-paid profession, considering the education that they have. And I wish they were better paid. They might pay me more money. But seriously, they are working. There's a lot of science out there to be discovered. And I attended several of their professional society meetings where they exchange papers, and it's really a fascinating thing to see. And I would invite you to come and watch to see the science that is being done by these folks. But it takes a whole lot of time just to find out lots of narrow things. And it's going to be, it's a lot of changing environmental things going on out there. And it's to try and find what the specific causes of specific activities are, specific results are, it's not the kind of science that's done overnight. I don't think we're going to be knowing everything there is to know about wildlife and fish biology in the state for years and years and years and years and years and years to come. We're trying to find what we can.
Weren't we just the recipients of one of those great scientific studies by some biologist here on the supposed pesticide effects on salmon?
Mr. Chair,
I'd hope we aren't victims of a whole bunch more of that kind of junk.
There was a publication that was produced by a biologist about the effects of pesticides on salmon. That's correct.
Are you going to pass this bill tonight? Oh, you're not. Okay. I'm going
to look. Let me just make the offer. I'd be happy, Mr. Chair, if the committee is interested in having the people who wrote that to come and make a presentation and stand some criticism and ask them to be asked some questions.
Okay, we'll get back to you on that.
All right.
Thank you.
I think they'll do that and just fire Blendley. Thank you.
Pick on the lobbyist, right? Glenn Stonebridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, once again, my name is Sam Stumblink, representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. In fact, I appreciate not coming up first because it's interesting to hear some of the other comments that are made and have an opportunity to make comments about them. One of them was to, in reference to the Federal Endangered Species Act and the Oregon Endangered Species Act. If you look at the Federal Endangered Species Act, when they declare a species to be endangered, they are then required to provide a plan for recovery and to pay for it. But we have all of these listings, and we don't have plan one, and they're not paying for it. But as we know, and I was curious if there was a fiscal or a revenue impact statement with this bill. I didn't ask ahead of time. It would be interesting to find out at some time what savings this would be to ODF&W and any other agencies like Oregon Department of Transportation if the Oregon Endangered Species Act was repealed.
And you could be right. There could be significant implications. When I was back in Washington, D.C. last year, I went up to US DOT, and I asked them, I said, are we spending more or substantially more than other states when it comes to environmental impact reports when it comes to roads? And they said yes. The main thing about that, though, is that probably this issue has actually stopped any construction. Because as you've heard, we're missing 90.5 miles per road. We haven't built any in the last 10 years. So it may have significant consequences because each year you postpone building of additional lane capacity, you're going to look at significant impacts in the future. You know, we've seen the 300% increase in congestion, so it could be
canceled. I agree, and I don't know how far this goes. Without the previous testimony, I didn't know that Oregon Department of Transportation is involved with this as well. But I guess really the question is here, when do we come forward, as Senator Weil did here, and said, how about some less government? How about some less laws rather than let's build some more government and always cost more, and then we compete for those scarce tax dollars or try to find ways to increase taxes? And so this is a breath of fresh air, whether it passes or not, to see something come forward to say let's reduce government and let's have less taxes or less increase. It's interesting as a former farmer and rancher to see all of the rhetoric that goes on about how we are destroying the earth, and yet in the county where I spent most of my time doing this, in Wallow County, people have been there for more than 150 years doing the same things that we were doing just and still doing at the present time. We love the land, whether we get to be the owners or just the stewards. We love the land, we love the things that are on there, and to be chastised as some kind of vulgar enemy of the land is a little disheartening. But to have some reality to our government and to our taxes is a breath of fresh air. So why should this bill pass? The cost. What is the cost? I alluded to it slightly before. But when the Oregon legislators who created the present Endangered Species Act, they understood that there could be a huge burden to the Oregon taxpayers, and they stated so in the act, and I'll just read it. It's very short, and I quote, "The burden of protecting and recovering the threatened species or endangered species can be a significant cost to the citizens of this state, and it would therefore be the policy of this state to minimize duplication and overlap between state and federal laws dealing with threatened species or endangered species." As we have experienced since the last legislative session, the federal ESA is supreme and will rule over all species on all lands and waters of this state. We know that is a fact. Therefore, to carry out the law of Oregon itself, I believe it is quite proper to minimize the duplication by eliminating the Oregon Endangered Species Act. The law itself is self-cleansing to say, we don't want duplication, and we have it. And even if we didn't want some species listed, the federal government has the power to list it anyway. Two, Oregon's Fish and Wildlife Commission and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, who are basically charged with carrying out the Endangered Species Act, have utilized Oregon's ESA to create law through rulemaking. That was never the intent of the creators of this law. Now, I gave you some handouts, and I will refer to those handouts. You don't have to study them at all, but as you'll see, there are some yellow marks on those handouts in several pages. Within the last year, there was a very controversial memorandum of understanding between several federal agencies and the governor of the state of Oregon. Very quickly, and I won't go into the controversy of it because that's not the crux of it, but it was to be able to obtain information about private landowners that they cannot presently obtain right now, and that's why we were so very concerned with this MOU. But the centerpiece of the MOU was called Species of Concern, and that's where you see the yellow marks throughout those pages. Species of Concern was the kingpin of it. The MOU defined the species of concern to mean, and if you look at the bottom of page of the first page of that MOU, you'll see that it says state listed and sensitive species. So you have to follow me with this a little bit. We have a species of concern, which is the kingpin of the MOU, which is to get information about private landowners they can't get otherwise. How did they get the species of concern? They got it through the sensitive species. Now, so I went to the Oregon Administrative Rules, and sure enough, put out by the Fish and Wildlife Commission in its rules, in rule number 4, it under the definitions of OAR 635100001, part 4, there is a definition for sensitive species, and that anyone can request any species to be listed as sensitive. Now, in that rule, they list various Oregon revised statutes. So the rule is now listing the law where they got the authority to do this. But guess what? The Oregon revised statutes do not allow. They do not define a sensitive species whatsoever. So you have created a term that's used to promote something else which creates laws. Law is being created through the rulemaking process, not by state and federal endangered species law. The point here is this, that Oregon Endangered Species Act is being used as a convenient tool by federal agencies to attain their agenda. And in conclusion, the Oregon ESA has duplicative and the supreme override of the federal ESA. ORSs require minimizing duplication to reduce cost, and I think in this time of our legislation we should be doing looking at everything we can to reduce cost. And Oregon's ESA is being utilized by special interests to attain goals not intended by the makers of the original ESA. I would like to see this bill, I'd like to ask you to reduce the burden to Oregon taxpayers, put the money in other areas like schools and roads, or just reduce taxes. That would be novel. I'd like to answer any questions you might have.
Glenn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lorna Young and Robert Munkey from Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lorna Young, Assistant Director at the Department of Agriculture. And with me is Dr. Robert Menke, who is the manager and chief scientist for our Endangered Plant Species Program, which we've administered since 1987. And we were coming before you today for a couple of purposes. One, to express some of our concerns about the bill, and also to provide you an opportunity to get a little more information about the plant species, Endangered Species Program for Plants in our department, which is a modestly funded but we think highly successful program that has done what was intended to do, which is to help prevent the listing of species and provide a buffer between the states so we have a little more control over our program and the feds, and also to recover plants. And we've been successful in all three, and I've asked Dr. Menke to come in and explain a little bit more about how the program has been administered. He's been with the program since 1987 when it began. Thank you.
Chairman George and committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. There are three points I'd really like to raise that I think are worthy of consideration when we're looking at this bill in relation to plant species. Some of these have been talked about a little bit already today, but I'll reiterate somewhat. First off, state endangered plant laws really do provide a buffer, I think, against what would ultimately become total federal control of species protection issues in the state for plants. We feel at the Department of Ag that it really is desirable to maintain state participation in endangered species protection of plants. Secondly, ODA truly has successfully limited listings of plants under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and we feel that's important too. Right now we have 61 species of listed plants in the state, and that's out of somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,400 plants that go wild in the state, so it's really a pretty small number. We've achieved this, I think, through a program that really limits land use conflict through sensible recovery efforts and field work and inventory studies. And I think it's really important to point out, which has been pointed out already, but point out again, that there's never been a case in Oregon where private property owners have been negatively impacted by endangered plant species, never. I think finally, last but not least, native plants are certainly essential components of Oregon's natural and economic heritage, and they have realized and potential intrinsic value. Well, to go back briefly to your point, if Senate Bill 1111 becomes law, Oregon will indeed become the only western state, and I think maybe the only state in the union, but I can't state that definitively, that will lack state government programs designed to monitor and conserve vulnerable native plants. I think that...
Hang on. You think that this bill would eliminate all the other laws that are out there that do just what you just said, that do protect plants and animals?
Senator, I can't speak for animals, but for plants, I don't know of any other laws in the state that would address specifically protections on state properties for given species of plants that we feel are about to go extinct.
But agencies couldn't do that on their own?
I don't know whether agencies could. I suppose they could do that on their own if they were so inclined. I'm not sure that they would be inclined to do so or not.
Okay, so what you're suggesting is if they're not inclined, that's probably a substantial cost to them.
Actually, I'll get to that in a minute, but I can speak to that now, too, as well. Endangered plants, actually, it's a drop in the bucket when it comes to environmental protection in the state. One reason, Chairman George, is that unlike animal species, and I don't want to try to draw comparisons between animals and plants that would reflect negatively on animals at all. I'm not trying to do that, but I think a lot of people don't realize that when it comes to plant species, most plant species that get to the point of actually getting listed as endangered or threatened in the state have such tiny populations that we're talking about populations, maybe five or six populations less than the size of this room, and that's it. There's a plant, for example, that we work at on Klamath Falls. There are three sites smaller than this room. That's the only place in the world this plant grows. It's an interesting legume that has genes in it that are related to clover and alfalfa and soy. And this is a plant that could very easily go extinct without our intervention. We're working right now on a project with OSU to try to learn how to grow this plant and reintroduce it in the field at a fraction of the cost that many environmental programs cost. And it's really a drop in the bucket. And another interesting point, too, economically speaking, is that when you have plant species like this, which are just pinpricks on the landscape, the chances of them economically impacting industry, agriculture, development in the state are virtually nil. We've never had a case yet in the 11 years I've been doing this program where there was even a minor negative economic impact on any landowner, public or private, in the state of Oregon with relation to a plant. So I think that's worth considering.
And because I'm just wondering, how do you find these plant species? I mean, if, say, I'm developing a field or something, and I've got a cat out there, there's no way I'm going to know.
No.
I've run across a plant species that might be very sensitive or endangered or anything else.
Senator George, Senator Wild, no, it is very difficult to find these populations sometimes. What we do is we rely extensively on records, old records that are kept at places like Oregon State and University of Oregon, in these facilities that are known as herbarium or herbaria. And a herbarium is a a historic record and collection of plants that sometimes stretch back to Oregon, early Oregon explorers back in the mid to late 1800s. And we then get information on where some of these populations originally occurred, what kinds of habitats they were in. And then, of course, we don't go on private land because we don't have the authority to go on private land. But we do go on public lands when we have the abilities, the budget and whatnot to do so, and search out these plants and see if we can look at them. We also often rely on input from the public, input from other agencies in the state that occasionally run across these plants. But again, I need to emphasize that we're talking about plants that are so limited in their distribution and don't migrate and are just stuck in one little spot. What we're really doing is we're preserving a handful of genes here and there across the landscape. Genes that we don't, as was mentioned earlier, we just don't know what potential they may have. We're talking about plants in the grass family and the legume family and other families that are very economically important potential crop species. And so I think that these are worth considering.
Do we do anything like is done in zoos? I mean, I don't know about this area, so that's why I'm asking questions about this. Such as, do we take the seeds from these plants and try to grow them elsewhere or keep them going in some way? I have no idea.
Chairman George, Senator Wild, we do have some limited private opportunities within some of the western states and other states in the country at botanic gardens, which are generally pretty poorly funded, to maintain seed banks of some of these species. And the Department of Agriculture has been contributing over time to a facility in Portland area, the Berry Botanic Garden, which is a privately run organization that will accept donations of seeds from us. But it's really not a very good way to go about preserving these species. Preserving them in situ or on the ground is what we want to do, even if it's small spots, because what that does is allows these species to interbreed naturally. You may collect plants at one particular year, and maybe that was a bad year for it, and they all inbred or something, you know what I mean? So these are kinds of biological questions that we need to deal with. They're kind of difficult to consider. But really preserving these little tiny pockets on the ground where they're at, as long as we can do it on public land and not cause a lot of economic impact, is really what the Department of Agriculture strives to do.
Tender Fisher.
Now, the yew tree was mentioned earlier, and the product that was given for it, and you talk about a flight of fancy or something, it had about the half-life of worm farming impact on the horizon of productivity, because synthetic was developed, and I don't know if you could sell a handful of a 100-pound barrel of yew bark now for anything, whether anybody would want it. Probably go back to the fact that it makes a pretty good fence post, and a few Native Americans used to carve bows out of it years ago. Probably that's about where it stands. So have a handful of plants that are going to be inbred and outbred and so forth, and make that much of an indentation on society one way or the other. They probably came out of a contaminated batch of chewing tobacco that somebody spit out there when they were going through Pioneer Woods from somewhere else. I mean,
well, Chairman George, Senator Fisher, if I may, I realize that when it came to the yew, which incidentally is not a species that we have listed as threatened or endangered, but when it came to the yew, you weren't going to be able to synthesize that drug unless you had a natural product to begin with to realize what you were working with. And if we had lost the yew prior to that that drug work that was done with it, we wouldn't have had that ability to synthesize that drug. And so I think that's important. It was a template, really, for creating the drug that I guess is used now in ovarian cancer treatment and whatnot. But I think that again, you know, a handful of plants is really something of all you need. What you need is the genes that we're working with, that we may then be able to use in breeding programs or in drug synthesis or whatever it might be. And again, nobody here is suggesting that we're trying to conserve vast acreages of plant species that really aren't that rare. What we're talking about is we're talking about the rarest of the rare. And if I could take you out in the field sometime and show you what I'm talking about, I think you'd be surprised at just how dwindling some of these species are. And these are species that aren't just figments of our imagination. These are recognized species that authorities throughout the country recognize as very interesting plants They're in many cases found only in Oregon and nowhere else in the world, and in some cases only like within the boundaries of Klamath Falls or whatever place we're working in, nowhere else in the world.
And we are not or southern Oregon?
Center Georgia, Center Fisher, there is a plant, correct, in the southern Oregon area. Yeah, but mostly on private lands where there actually is no provision for protecting that species. So that's true.
Yes, sir, yeah.
I find this very interesting. So, do we have any of these plant species that are a dominant food source for, say, an animal species, or would they just, I mean, oftentimes, like, say, for a particular type of butterfly, say, I mean, I'm going off on another tangent, but it likes a particular type of plant, and mm-hmm. it's very much drawn to that, mm-hmm. so it's drawn to an area that has that plant. And I'm just wondering if many of these species draw particular types of animals or insects to their area, and if they're important in a micro ecosystem.
Well, Senator George, Senator Wild, we do have some cases like that. There's a case in the Willamette Valley of a plant, again, in the legume family, which has a particular odd relationship with a butterfly. They recently discovered this down at Oregon State. And this is, again, one of these cases where it's a plant that's found on a couple of hillsides around the valley, not much bigger than this room here. And they happened to find this butterfly growing with it or living with it and flying around with it. And there was sort of an ecological interdependence there. I think in many cases, though, because these populations of the plants have dwindled, some of them over the years, though in some cases they naturally were just extremely rare, we don't really know what might be missing from that little microsystem right now. We don't really have an idea. You know.
Just to try to get a grip on some of the implications of the bill, let's back up to the yew tree, if you would. If the yew tree had been listed, would it have been possible to do the research in order to develop taxol?
Senator George, yes, it certainly would have been. There are provisions within our rules, and I'm sure within the Federal Endangered Species Act as well, I couldn't speak for sure on that, that we do have provisions for allowing take of plants when it comes not only for those kinds of obviously very important purposes, but obviously, but as well for perhaps less, I won't say less important, but issues maybe less grave, such as horticultural use or nursery use. We have provisions for people to take species that we have listed for research work at Oregon State or wherever else it might be. So we certainly do have take provisions for those kinds of things, yes.
I haven't been managing the time very well. We're going to need to move right along because there are several of us that need to be at another meeting. And is there anything further? Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Rich Berry and Martin Nugent, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Good evening, Chair George. For the record, my name is Rich Berry. I'm the Wildlife Division Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today, I have Martin Nugent from our Wildlife Management Program, who deals with our Wildlife Diversity Program, and one of the areas that he also covers is issues related to the Endangered Species Act. We have testimony that we are handing out to you today, and just concerns that we also have relating to the Act. I might try to summarize that in the interest of time, since you have the written statement also with there. Primarily, that one of the things that we have a concern over is that, remember that the State Act is, in fact, for state-owned lands, is where we are trying to do something as a state. In many cases, can we do something as a state before we end up with a federally listed species? And so a number of the work that we do with ourselves and other state agencies, and also we have private landowners cooperating in these efforts, trying to preserve some species or maintain some species, before we speak to a federal
refuge. Yes. Let me ask a question real quick, and we'll go to you. Do we know the total cost of all the agencies in this?
Senator George, I do not know the cost for other agencies. We have a very small number of state dollars that we spend. Most of the dollars that we come in, both either trying to maintain species or are federal dollars that come in from a match. And previously, I believe another speaker testified that they feel those could be jeopardized. We also feel that way. Most of our dollars come from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and without having some criteria why we are doing our work, we may not meet the federal criteria why we would get the dollars to try to prevent some of these listings.
Senator Fisher.
Yeah,
paragraph here where you talk about this endangered species act, if we respect the allow the take, sale, and export of species that are not federally listed. Now, that's a bunch of baloney. We've got laws. We went through there and spent the whole interim working on the sale of wildlife parts, and they're specifically excluded from that alone. So we don't need the Endangered Species Act in the first place. Where do these whales grow in Oregon? And most they do would come once in a great while in the Oregon territorial waters, perhaps, or the federal territorial waters on here. This doesn't take them out of the Marine Mammal Act. There's none of the people that can go and take that kind of a species and start selling it around here. Go take it or export it or something without being in serious trouble with a whole bunch of other laws.
Senator Fisher, you're correct in the Marine Mammal Act as far as the gray whale is concerned. This is not a federally listed species, but it is on the state list. They are migratory through here. Also, as you were aware, went through the sale of wildlife park. We also have our wildlife integrity, where we would, in fact, go through the process that you described of looking at the animal, whether it could be legally held or taken or created. So there is a process to review those. With the State Endangered Species Act, though, depending on how they're listed, you can essentially close that door on some of those.
Senator Duke?
Senator Duke, no, we have a migratory population.
How do you get on our State Endangered Species Act if you don't live here?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Duke, the species that you're referring to there, mostly when the State Act came into being, the species that were in Oregon and federally listed at that time were automatically listed on the State Act. And in 1988, through rulemaking, all those species were reviewed and considered at that time by the Fish and Wildlife Commission. Some species that were there remained there, and some species that were on the original commission list were reviewed, and some were removed at that time. But the gray whale is an example of one of those species that was on the state list from the start because it was federally listed. And the Fish and Wildlife Commission at the moment are initiating or have undertaking rulemaking now to remove that species from the list.
And let me ask a question relative to that, and it's curious about the name of the Arctic peregrine falcon. Is there a reason Arctic is in there in the name? Does it have a cousin, or is it...
Mr. Chairman, there are two peregrine populations that occur in the state. The Arctic peregrine, or tundra peregrine, is one that occurs only very rarely in Oregon as a migrant. The other is the American peregrine, which is a resident and also migratory species, and one that is recovering too, and again a species that the Fish and Wildlife Commission are considering to reclassify, haven't they?
I think those populations are recurring too, are recovering, and I'm just wondering, what did we do that? I think it's recurring naturally.
Well, we, Mr. Chairman, as a program, we were involved in 1985, we had a single pair in Oregon, and we were involved we had an established conservation program through the ESA to bring in funds from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we were involved with the reintroduction of the peregrine across the state, and we've reintroduced something like 170 peregrines. They have now started to breed. We've also had birds coming from California and elsewhere in the range where they've also been recovering, and they too are breeding. We now have 68 known sites in Oregon because of the conservation effort and site protection that we've been able to achieve.
I hear a lot of folks complaining because they've wiped out their quail population and aren't real happy about what the numbers are doing to some of the birds that we consider very highly.
But, Mr. Chairman, the peregrine numbers are still very, very small, and so I'd be surprised that they're making a huge impact to quail populations. They do take a whole range of different species, including some of those that we have difficulties with and problems with, like starling.
Canada geese.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, peregrine falcons have been known to take Canada geese. You know, small Canada geese, like lesser Canada geese or cackling, have been taken by female peregrine falcons that are larger than the males. And that has been seen several times.
Again, we feel that the tool is, and with the state ESA and the language that we currently have, is a tool that we can work with other state agencies to first try to protect and to maintain some of these populations through the state, and certainly on state land. A concern that we have is we try to do, and yes, we've seen a number of federal listed species come forward, even though we've taken some efforts here, but as a state, should we have a policy that we try to maintain populations on the state-owned lands first so we can minimize impacts on private lands? Once it goes to a federal listing, the impact is going to hit both state and private lands to a much larger degree than what it would under the state ESA, and hopefully we could maintain the species with our state, within our state lands and populations that we have with, or programs that we have with either other state agencies or, in fact, cooperative landowners.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Myron, Oregon Trout.
Jim, if you don't mind, we're going to go ahead and call the next person up.
Okay. Esther Gruber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jim Myron, representing Oregon Trout. I'll just briefly comment on a practical example of why we feel the State Endangered Species Act is an important tool to continue to have. Relative to Columbia River coho salmon, a number of years ago, Oregon Trout had petitioned under the Federal Act for protection of Columbia River coho salmon. The National Marine Fisheries Service determined that the fish were extinct, that all that were left in the Columbia Basin were hatchery fish, so they refused to list them. We subsequently filed a petition under the State Act on coho statewide. The Fish and Wildlife Commission determined that...
So did that occur on the basis of our state endangered species? Your action?
I believe that our state petition on coho was filed back about 1994. It was prior to the most recent revisions to the State Act, which I believe was in 1995.
Did you use it as a basis for your suit?
It wasn't a suit. We filed a petition to list Columbia Basin coho under the State Act after the feds had declined to list the coho salmon in the Columbia Basin. And ODSW determined that the listing was not warranted, but the commission directed them to do an annual review of the status of coho, and they've done that ever since. Last year, because of that annual status review, the staff at ODSW determined that there were still some wild populations left in the Columbia Basin, particularly in the Clackamas and Sandy Rivers. They've probably been extirpated everywhere else except those two streams, and the population levels of those fish were down to less than 200 fish in most instances. In fact, 3 years ago, the Clackamas population had 4 returning fish. So the department is now looking at doing a status review of the Clackamas and Sandy River coho salmon for a potential to list those fish as endangered under the State Act. Here is a perfect example of the need for the State Act because the feds failed to consider the fact that there were still wild coho salmon left in the Columbia Basin. So I just wanted to briefly comment. Senator Dukes, I doubt if there's been any DNA testing of those fish. The fish are counted at both. There are two dams on both the lower Sandy and the lower Clackamas River where they've monitored population levels for quite a period of time, and they count the returning fish, and I think they differentiate the wild and hatchery by the run timing. The wild fish come later in the year than the hatchery fish. So I think that's how they're able to differentiate between the hatchery and the wild stock. But you might ask them that question specifically.
Is it possible that some of the hatchery fish just slowed down somewhere?
Well, it was historically, particularly in the Clackamas River, as I understand it, historically a sizable timing difference between the wild run, which was a late run, and when they developed the hatchery program, they purposely developed an early returning fish that wouldn't compete with the wild populations. And as a result of this review by the state, the feds are now again reviewing these populations for potential listing under the federal act. But without the state doing what they're doing, the feds would have not had any incentive to do that.
Can't believe it. You're following my line of thought completely ahead of me.
Dan, that's what you're talking about. So I'm going to say I agree with you, but I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Come up there, you're all right. Because you might want to pull that mic a little closer.
Good evening, Senator George and members of the Senate Ag and Natural Resources Committee. I'm going to be reiterating a number of items that have already been addressed tonight, but it's easier for me just to read what I already put together.
I can't read the whole thing because we're...
Well,
okay.
I came all the way from Corvallis.
Okay,
I would like
read
to
read it. Go ahead. I'm easy.
My name is Esther Gruber McAvoy, and I was the legislative chair of the Native Plant Society of Oregon for 10 years. The Native Plant Society of Oregon is dedicated to the enjoyment, conservation, and study of Oregon's native vegetation. We have over 1,000 members throughout the state. I worked for years on crafting and on the passage of the State Endangered Species Bill with numerous individuals from many different societies, groups, and state agencies. In 1987, the amended version of the State Endangered Species Bill cleared the House floor 60-0 and the Senate floor 23-0. Vera Katz, who was Speaker of the House at that time, spoke favorably. We weren't sure we wanted this bill when they were through, but we looked at the finished product. Everyone agreed on the bill. Everyone agreed it was a step forward. I come here today before this committee because repealing the State Endangered Species Act is a great step backwards for the state of Oregon, for its people, and for its natural heritage. Senate Bill 1111 will repeal the State Endangered Species Act and all the statutes that refer to it. Repealing the State Endangered Species Act will allow only federal agencies to have say on the estate on threatened and endangered species of plants and animals in our state. Without state involvement, only the federal government will decide on protection and management of rare species. Repealing the State Act will weaken the ability for the state to get matching federal funds for recovering species and for preventing federal threatened and endangered species listing. The repeal of our State Endangered Species Act will cripple the ability for the state to protect its rare plant and animal species before they are federally listed. The repeal of the state law sends a message that we do not care about our precious natural heritage. Under the current law, there is a coordination through the state agencies to help with listing species not covered by the federal listing. By listing rare species on state lists and giving state protection, it is possible to avoid federal listing. State protection of listed species can help bring about federal funding and will also help with delisting of species as populations recover. It takes a very long time for a plant or an animal species to get federally listed. Unfortunately, by the time many of the rare species get on a federal list, their populations are precariously low. This is why it is critical for the state to have a state list of threatened and endangered plants and animals, which goes beyond the few listed by the federal government. To get ahead of the curve of the federal listing and the extension of species, we need to support the state program and the state listing under the State Endangered Species Act. The wildlife program administered by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife under the State Act has been working on delisting at least 2 federally listed birds. This effort is a direct result of cooperation with the federal government and the existing state program under the State Endangered Species Act. The plant program administered by Oregon Department of Agriculture has a state list of 61 threatened endangered species, of which only 9 are federally listed. One of the federally listed plants has been downlisted from endangered to threatened in part by the work done by the ODA recovery program under the State Endangered Species Act. The state of Oregon is blessed with a great biodiversity of habitats. It is documented that in Oregon there are more than 450 species that are listed as globally rare or sensitive. We need to protect our rare sensitive species. The State Endangered Species Act is providing a base for that framework. Representative Carl Hostetter has said in 1987 about the State Endangered Species Act, "We know the foundation of all natural resources in this world is the gene pool and genetic diversity that is available to us. The gene pool is rapidly being diminished throughout the world, and the Pacific Northwest is no exception." Thank you.
Mr. G,
year.
Mm-hmm. Senator Fisher.
There's an oddity that really strikes me. Everybody wants everything to go native, to go back, to be left alone, to do this. And all of a sudden we got this great big push to start protecting all these species that have gone dormant and gone out of production and extinct all the way through time. And now we're tampering with that, but lo and behold, we could possibly tamper with thing or something like that. It's just really illogical. And I can say that you talk about destroying the farmers, destroying loggers, destroying that, and all this kind of stuff. I can tell you from 100 years of experience, and some of the people have been there closer to the land than I am, for about 100 years, our relations and earlier families and generations have been farming land in eastern Washington, which isn't that far from Oregon. They came around from farming in Oregon. The amount of crops that were able to be produced off that land when it was so-called in its virgin strength and all of this pristine condition was basically nothing. You might have been able to graze one cow or one buffalo or one bighorn sheep or one deer on about 20 square acres per year. 2 years ago, they took the highest yielding crop ever in its history, a crop that averaged over 68 bushels per acre. When my grandfather farmed it, they were lucky if they could get an average of about 15, maybe 20. 30 was looked upon as an unheard of yield. If we were going with crops like that nowadays, nobody'd have wheat for bread. Crops are averaging much more than the low or the high crops ever made back in those days. And that's because we're greedy farmers. We've been destroying the land. We've been doing all this kind of stuff to it. We don't care about it. All we want to do is make money off of it. And yet we're protecting it to the point that we're producing as much as the 2.5 best yield that they ever got off of it before. All just, you know, more natural and all this kind of stuff when they were plodding it with the horses were fertilizer and all of this kind of stuff. It absolutely boggles my mind because the people that are working the environment are taking care of it. They are interested in it. They're not out there just being greedy. They're trying to take care of their land so they have something to handle. Generation. Somebody has a gall in the tent to come here and tell me that we don't care for the land, or that we're not close to the land, or that we're not interested in the land, don't understand the land that they do. Let's get real.
Thank you very much. That's it. We completed the list. I want to thank everyone for being here tonight. It looks like it's about time this meeting is to end. My voice is going away. And so I'm going to go ahead now, and I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1111. And with that, we'll be adjourned.